Third case for oral argument this morning is the Surgical Institute of South Dakota Appellant versus Matthew J. Sorrell, M.D., Appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. James Moore and Mr. James Power, attorneys from Sioux Falls. And Mr. Moore, I understand you'll be presenting this morning.
That's correct.
Very well. And for the appellee, we have Mr. Alex Hagan, an attorney also from Sioux Falls. Justice Wilbur has disqualified herself, and the court has appointed the Honorable Robert A. Miller, former justice of this court, to sit in her place. Mr. Moore, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. I'm James Moore, together with Jim Power, on behalf of the Surgical Institute. In a nutshell, this case is about a surgeon, Dr. Sorrell, who renegotiated the terms of his employment agreement to eliminate a restrictive covenant that would have prevented him from working within 100 miles of Sioux Falls for 2 years after leaving the employment of the Surgical Institute so that he could do a one-year fellowship. As part of the deal, Avera McKinnon, which was not his employer, but which was the health group principally served by Surgical Institute, extended him a fellowship loan in the amount of $225,000. Because Dr. Sorrell promised to return after the completion of his fellowship, and that was implicit in the understanding between Dr. Sorrell and Surgical Institute extended him other benefits, including payment of deferred compensation, health insurance, retirement benefits, malpractice coverage, disability benefits during the time that he was away on fellowship. 3 months before the end of his fellowship, Dr. Sorrell called two of his partners, and this testimony is undisputed. On June 10th of 2008, he called Dr. Wingert and he called Dr. Baker, and he told them that he was not returning to the group. Surgical Institute gave him essentially 48 hours and an email in which they asked him to confirm his intentions to leave, which he did not respond to. And after that, they sent him a letter on June 13th accepting his resignation. They treated his statement he was not coming back as a repudiation of his contractual obligation. Dr. Sorrell eventually found employment at Sanford Health System, a competing health system in Sioux Falls, leaving Surgical Institute in need of another surgeon to cover call, which they did for a one-year period by employing locum tenens, having spent considerable money to enable a fellowship that turned out to be not only for the benefit of Surgical Institute, but it turned out to be for the benefit of a competing health system. On these facts, the trial court refused to allow the jury to hear any evidence that Dr. Sorrell had promised to return.
Was there a reason stated for that?
Your Honor, it was decided on a motion in limine. And the grounds for the motion in limine were essentially that it violated the parole evidence rule, that it was irrelevant, and that it was prejudicial. Judge Rypel did not offer, as I recall, any statement in the transcript why she was granting the motion, and there was no written decision. The grounds that are then urged on appeal are different, and they're that, that the evidence would have been confusing and that it would have caused undue delay, and I don't think either of those is the case.
And those weren't raised in the motion in limine?
I don't think they were, Your Honor. I think they're entirely distinct from the grounds that were raised in the motion in limine. And I'll be happy to address that issue in some detail in the context of the second issue, which is the breach of contract claim. Essentially, there are three issues presented in the appeal. The first is the circuit court granted summary judgment on Surgical Institute's unjust enrichment claim, which seeks to recover the benefits that were paid to Dr. Sorrell while he was gone, on the theory that he was unjustly enriched by keeping them when he, in fact, had promised to return. The second claim and argument is a breach of contract claim that depends on his employment contract, which was still in effect, and which required him to give 9 months' notice if he was going to leave the employment of Surgical Institute. That claim was tried to the jury. And as part of that claim, we have the evidentiary issue about whether the jury should have been allowed to hear evidence that Dr. Sorrell had promised to return. And then lastly, if you conclude that there is another trial that's necessary in this case, there is an issue related to for what period Surgical Institute would be entitled to recover damages on the breach of contract claim. I want to start with the unjust enrichment claim, which was dismissed by the circuit court on a motion for summary judgment. And the transcript of Judge Teedy's decision is included in the appendix, and it's not entirely clear why, while why Judge Tiede came to the conclusion that he did. He considered the crux of the issue, which is whether the issue between the parties was covered by the employment contract, the shareholders' agreement. And what Judge Tiede concluded is that it was not. Judge Tiede concluded, I think correctly, that the parties had not performed those agreements in detail. Obviously, the employment agreement was still in effect, but Dr. Sorrell was on a fellowship. He was contractually obligated to work full-time in Sioux Falls for Surgical Institute. He was obligated to cover call in addition to working full-time, and he was entitled to a full salary. None of those things occurred. And so the question is there something in writing that obligated Surgical Institute to pay him the benefits that were paid while he was on leave for the fellowship? And Judge Tiede basically said there isn't anything in writing. And I think that the analysis is as simple as he erred in concluding that under those circumstances, unjust enrichment doesn't apply, even though there was a contractual relationship between the parties and even though there was a valid claim for breach of contract between the parties, because that particular issue was not addressed in the contract. And I think it's clear, first of all, there really isn't much dispute about the law that applies in this case. There are relatively few cases that I think the court needs to look at. This court recognized in Johnson versus Larson, which was decided in 2010, a principle that stated in the Restatement of Restitution from Section 2, unjust enrichment can apply in a contract context when the performance received was not specified by the contract. And that's exactly the situation here. The performance that Dr. Sorrell received from Surgical Institute in terms of the benefits that were paid while he was on leave was not specified in the shareholder agreement or in the employment contract.
Wouldn't we be running the risk of opening the floodgates for every contract that's not 30 pages single space covering every contingency, that if there's some kind of a dispute, we now have an unjust enrichment claim? Well, which is basically an equity claim.
It is. It's equitable. It's distinct from the breach of contract claim. It's not clear how it would be decided in the case. For instance, it could be decided with an advisory jury. It could be decided by the court on a trial to the court. It could be decided in this case even if you affirm the jury's verdict on the breach of contract claim. You could still reverse on the unjust enrichment claim and send it back. So it's entirely distinct. The limits, Your Honor, that exist on the unjust enrichment on the unjust enrichment claim flow from the elements of unjust enrichment. And that is that it has to be, there has to be a benefit conveyed, the recipient has to be aware of the benefit, and then it has to be inequitable for the recipient to keep the benefit that was conveyed without payment. And the reason that it would be inequitable in this case all relates to Dr. Sorrell's promise to return. Surgical Institute would not have agreed to send him on a fellowship and have paid him all the benefits that were paid if it had not understood that he was coming back and if, in fact, he had not expressly agreed to come back, which he did. And that's undisputed. There isn't testimony about that in the trial transcript because it was not a case, it was not a claim that was tried. But I think, Your Honor, that those, the limits come from the confines of the unjust enrichment claim. And it's actually going to be relatively rare. I mean, the exception exists as a black letter rule of law. It's stated, it's there. If the issue is not addressed in the contract, then it is possible for an unjust enrichment claim to exist. And despite the fact that there were 30 pages of contract documents here, this issue was clearly not addressed by the parties in the written agreement. And I think that Judge Tiede said, I don't know why that is. I'm not sure whether it was an abundance of good faith. I'm not sure what happened is what he said. I don't think we can do any better than that. But what we know is that it was not addressed in the written agreements. And under those circumstances, I think it's as simple as saying that the unjust enrichment claim exists, that there were facts that meet each element of what you have to prove to be entitled to unjust enrichment. And on that basis, the claim should have been considered either by the court or by the jury sitting as an advisory jury in connection with hearing the claim for breach of contract. I don't think you have to decide for purposes of appeal whether the unjust enrichment claim would have had merit. I think that's for the trial court. The question on appeal is simply whether the trial court erred in granting summary judgment, saying as a matter of law, no unjust enrichment claim can exist under these facts. And that question depends entirely on reviewing the contracts to see whether they address the issues that were raised by Dr. Sorrell's departure and the benefits that were paid to him during that time.
Do I understand correctly that each of these benefits at issue under the unjust enrichment claim were granted pursuant to oral agreements at stockholders meetings?
Your Honor, there was a stockholders meeting, I think on June 13th of 2007, at which a number of the benefits were expressly addressed. Deferred compensation was not one of the benefits that was addressed at that point. There is an amendment to the shareholders agreement that talks about fellowship leave and talks about deferred compensation being paid in that context. It does not address the question of whether the deferred compensation can be retained if, in fact, the departing shareholder does not return to full employment, which is presumed in the amendment to the shareholders agreement.
So there is a written agreement about paying deferred comp on
it is
ship, but no agreement, no written agreement on being able to keep it.
That's correct.
But there's no contract term on fringe benefits. What is that, $64,000?
That's correct.
Is that what you're seeking?
Yes, exactly.
And the call cover, I guess.
You're right. Surgical Institute took the position that one of the benefits extended to Dr. Sorrell while he was on fellowship leave is that they covered his call obligation, which they did by, this is not a huge group. There were six of them at the time that these agreements were signed, and Dr. Calder retired. I think when Dr. Sorrell was gone, there were four of them who were covering his call, and they did that without hiring anyone extra. They just took on the extra call. So that was a burden, and it was a cost to them, and in that sense, it was a benefit to Dr. Sorrell. And I think that would play into the unjust enrichment claim.
Mr. Moore, the deferred comp was in the contract.
Was in an amendment that allowed him to take the fellowship leave.
Right, but the issue of deferred comp was addressed in the original contract. Was it not? Is that a vested interest? Is that
it was,
if you leave the partnership, do you take your deferred comp? How does that, was there? When I looked at it, I wasn't clear if I was missing it or if it wasn't handled.
I'm not sure the answer to that, Your Honor, because I don't think it applied. I didn't look to answer that question because I didn't think it applied to the facts of this case. Given that there was an amendment that was entered into that allowed, there had to be an amendment so he could leave to do the fellowship.
Well, wouldn't that fit in on the issue of whether or not it was an issue that was totally not covered by the contract, which would take us into the implied contract?
I think there's a legitimate question there, as you and Justice Zinner have now pointed out, with respect to the deferred comp. And our position is that it was not addressed and can still be the subject of an unjust enrichment claim because it didn't say what happens if you don't return.
Okay.
The other benefits that were conveyed, and they're $64,000 approximately, are clearly not addressed in the amendments to any of the written agreements or the written agreements themselves, to the extent that the written agreements without the amendments don't allow a fellowship leave.
Thank you.
I want to address the claim for breach of contract. The contract required that Dr. Sorrell provide 9 months' notice if he was going to leave employment with Surgical Institute. It's undisputed that on June 10, 2008, several weeks before his fellowship was to end, he called two doctors, Dr. Wingert and Dr. Baker, and he told them both the same thing, that he wasn't coming back, and that it's clear in the record that the conversation was different than the conversation that occurred before. There had been some conversation while he was gone in April about how he was going to be integrated back into the group, given that he had gone to do this fellowship in trauma surgery, and he was going to be doing some work in the intensive care unit, and how was that going to integrate with his work in the trauma unit, and how would it affect call, and they were talking about all of those things. But Dr. Wingert testified, actually, and this is at page 114 of the first volume of the transcript, that those were hallway conversations, is what he said. What changed on June 10, and Dr. Wingert is very clear about this, is that Dr. Sorrell called back and said, I'm not coming back. And he did say in that conversation that I'll talk to you about covering call for the 9 months to help you get through this, but I'm not coming back. And our position is very simply that his contractual obligation was to work full-time at Surgical Institute. His contractual obligation was not just to cover call. And so absent evidence that he was willing and said on June 10 that I'm not going to come back long-term, but I will come back at the conclusion of my fellowship, I will work full-time for 9 months and I'll cover call during that time, there's no evidence to support the jury's verdict for breach. There would be a question of fact for the jury to decide if Dr. Sorrell had disputed Dr. Wingert's version of the conversation and said, no, I said I was thinking about coming back. No, I told him that we should talk about whether I would come back, but he didn't do those things. Dr. Wingert said he told me he wasn't coming back. Dr. Sorrell had multiple opportunities in the transcript and during the trial to refute that and say that isn't what I said, and he didn't say that.
I thought he said he was willing and able to fulfill the notice requirements and would have done so if the Institute had given him a chance. But
that was Mr. Landon's argument, Your Honor.
Okay.
It's not supported by the testimony.
Well, what about the letter of June 20? That seems to be what was said there.
It was, Your Honor, and it was not admitted as evidence. The jury didn't have it.
Okay.
The trial court excluded it. And if the letter of June 20 comes in, the letter of June 13 comes in, and the letter of June, I think it's 18, they're on pages 96 and 97 of the appendix, but the first letter says that there was a termination, and that's Dr. Sorrell's counsel who refers to it as a termination. The second letter backtracks on that, but the first letter is on page 97, and it says, please be advised that while Dr. Sorrell indicated that things were not going to work going forward, he did not indicate that he intended to breach the agreement. And then it refers to, that's the June 20.
Yeah,
the June 18 letter says, I am in receipt of a letter from Dr. Strand regarding Dr. Sorrell's termination. Please be advised that while we may disagree with the characterization of the termination as being without cause, Dr. Sorrell did indicate that he would not be continuing with the group based upon a number of concerns. I mean, that's very clear. And that evidence was not considered by the jury. It was not admitted. But I think that it amply supports the facts that occurred. And it really supports the motion to the extent that that letter makes absolutely no sense. If Dr. Sorrell had not told Dr. Wingert that he was not coming back.
But I thought Dr. Sorrell testified that it wasn't a flat decision. When he was talking to Dr. Wingert, it wasn't a flat decision to not come back. Couldn't the jury weigh that and say, okay, where does that fit in?
He really didn't, Your Honor. Dr. Sorrell's testimony jives with Dr. Wingert's. They both agree that Dr. Sorrell made some offer to help out, but it was clear that he was not coming back. And his contractual obligation is not to help out. His contractual obligation is not to just cover call. His contractual obligation is to work full time. And at no time did he offer to do that. In fact, he expressly renounced his obligation to come back. Mark Hadding, the business administrator for the group, sent the email on June 11 and said, Dr. Wingert says you're not coming back. We're trying to put the call schedule together. Will you please confirm that? And Dr. Sorrell didn't reply. It would have been easy enough for him to write back and said, that's not what I said.
Why he didn't reply when he testified?
He basically said that he didn't think that was an issue that he needed to discuss with Mr. Hadding, implying that that was something that he would discuss with his partners, but not with the business administrator. That was his answer. I'm not very good at hypotheticals, but my hypothetical is the situation is no different than if Dr. Sorrell had not left for a fellowship, and if he had walked into Dr. Wingert's office on June 10 and said, Don, you're my good friend. I wanted to tell you this first. I'm leaving the group, but I'll be happy to work with you and to help cover call for the next 9 months. Would that be notice under the contract? Clearly not. He has an obligation to work full-time for the next 9 months. The fact that he was on fellowship or that he wouldn't have been on fellowship doesn't change his notice obligation under the contract. And I think that the evidence is undisputed. If you look in the transcript, particularly from Dr. Sorrell's testimony, the pages are 33, 35, and 37 in the first volume of the transcript, where he was asked questions that basically said, in your conversation when you told Dr. Wingert that you weren't coming back, and he never disagreed with the way the question was phrased. His answer was always essentially or yes or right. Dr. Wingert's testimony is in Volume 2 at pages 97 to 98, and Dr. Baker's testimony is in Volume 2 at page 71. And, you know, Dr. Wingert was clear. I am calling to tell you I am not coming back to the group. It was the first thing that was said. And there's nothing in the record from Dr. Sorrell to say that that's not the case. What was in the record was, I'll help cover call, and that's not sufficient to support the verdict, because he has a contractual obligation to work full-time.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Moore. Mr. Hagan, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. The jury was presented with two sharply different scenarios in this case about what happened between Dr. Sorrell and the Surgical Institute and how their relationship ended. What you've just heard is a closing argument. There was sharply disputed evidence as to whether Dr. Sorrell had preemptively and unilaterally terminated the relationship by resignation during a phone call on June 10th, which is what the Surgical Institute contended throughout trial. Dr. Sorrell disputed that. He adduced evidence in support of a competing theory. He did not resign, but he was preemptively terminated and prevented from giving notice that he intended to give. The question of the sufficiency of the evidence is the most important question of this appeal. It is the linchpin. It either informs or determines the secondary issues that the Institute has discussed or will discuss in their rebuttal. For that reason, we start with the challenge to the sufficiency of the evidence. The standard review is clear. Every piece of evidence is viewed in the light most favorable to the verdict. Every reasonable inference from the evidence is drawn in support of the verdict. Now, you've just been cited testimony from pages 33, 35, and 37. That was when Dr. Sorrell had been called adversely by counsel from the Surgical Institute. I would focus on pages 58 through 61 for testimony from Dr. Sorrell on direct, that he was given the opportunity to explain the context of the conversation, what he said, what he meant. And again, these facts aren't up for dispute on appeal. The jury has reached its verdict, and the question is whether there is a reasonable basis to support that verdict. The first issue is whether the threshold elements of a resignation were actually met in this case, and whether the jury had grounds to conclude that this did not constitute a resignation. Recall that the June 13th letter that the Institute sent made reference to termination without cause, and it made reference to the termination date as defined in the employment agreement. Well, the employment agreement also has a definition for termination without cause. And to constitute termination without cause is to give written notice. There is no resignation letter from Dr. Sorrell to the Institute saying, I resign effective as of this date, I quit, or anything like that. And the jury had reasonable grounds to conclude that this was not a resignation. We also have to recall the context. This is a telephone conversation to his close friend and partner. It follows conversations that happened in April and in May. Now, at no point in time does the Institute in a briefing attempt to give this court a sense of the context of the group dynamics, the basic dysfunction and discord that were going on at the Surgical Institute. As late as March 2008, Dr. Wingert, Dr. Strand, and Dr. Thamer had all expressed some concern about the viability of remaining with the group. And this is from testimony by Dr. Haddon. This was a group that was in flux, and Dr. Sorrell is in Utah during the entire year. Now, he's having conversations with Dr. Wingert in April and in May. He adduced testimony that Dr. Wingert told him, well, maybe you come back and work with Avera. And recall that the Institute has a contract with Avera, which is where all this call coverage comes from. And there was basically a fluid amount of discussions, and the notion that these contractual relationships from the Surgical Institute's point of view, and as stated by Dr. Winger, is that there was some play in the joints there. And that was the context of the conversation.
Help me understand. Is, Is it your position that a fair reading of the evidence would support a position that it was his intention to go back with the Institute?
Yes. Well, no. I think it was his intention to tell his partner and to tell his friend, you know, I'm not happy with this situation. I'm not coming back to remain as a long-term partner, but I will provide whatever is required to meet my contractual obligations. Now, this is testimony from page 70, page 71 and 72. We talked about this alternative job offer that he had in Nebraska. Now, what the Institute has done is said, well, he's just talking about helping to cover call and not fulfill his primary obligations. That's not the case. He had a job offer, and he explained that he would come back and work with the Institute, help out in whatever capacity they needed to, and put that job offer on hold until he had completed it. He was questioned on cross-examination, did you give this notice? And he explained, well, that's a false paradigm. I wasn't given the opportunity to give the notice, and I had intended to. This is actually bound up by admissions from Dr. Winger. Now, just to take a sort of step back, the June 10th conversation on the other side of the telephone is Dr. Winger. It's Dr. Sorrell and Dr. Winger continuing the series of conversations about what would happen when he comes back. Dr. Winger, in the meetings on June 18th, the minute meetings when he's meeting with his partners talking about what had just happened the week before, tells his partners, I think we acted too soon. This June 13th letter we sent, cutting things off, we acted too soon. Now, Dr. Wingett was on the other line. He was the only party. There was a conversation with Dr. Baker, but they relied primarily on Dr. Wingett. And he told his partners we acted too soon. Now, the legal theory that the Surgical Institute relies on is anticipatory repudiation. I would submit that that's a classic jury question because it involves what constitutes an unequivocal indication of intent not to perform. Throughout the transcript, there's testimony from Dr. Sorrell to the effect that he had told Dr. Winger that he would come back and help out in whatever capacity. He did indicate that he would not remain a long-term partner and that it was not a viable option. In addition to the admissions from Dr. Winger, there's also testimony in the record from other partners that indicated that this was a business decision. The decision from the Surgical Institute to cut off this relationship and not permit Dr. Sorrell to come back to work with the Institute to cover call was a business decision, in part motivated by lack of trust, which is understandable. But the jury also heard evidence that by painting Dr. Sorrell into a corner and classifying this as, well, he resigned without giving notice, it stood to benefit financially. And that's what the substance of the jury verdict is. There's what's called the early termination reduction, where if a partner slash employee terminates without giving his 9 months notice, there's a penalty. And that's what the Institute said that they were doing when they would not pay the remaining accounts receivable, which was about $15,000, and the value of his shares as a shareholder, which is about $26,000. The special verdict form asked the jury, question number one, did Dr. Sorrell fail to provide 9 months' notice to his employer? And the answer was no. He did not fail to provide that.
So you're saying, though, he didn't give 9 months' notice. You're saying he was never given the opportunity to give 9 months. Is that right?
There's two parts to it. This cannot constitute a formal resignation under the definition. And the jury had grounds to believe this wasn't a resignation. This was a conversation about how we would be integrated and an equivocation. You know, can I be integrated or not? So there's grounds to say it wasn't a resignation. If it was deemed a resignation, there's evidence in the record that it was offered with 9 months' notice. I'll put back this job that I have in Nebraska and come back, do whatever you want. Now, obviously,
essentially, the letter of June 20th, which wasn't admitted, you're saying that even though that wasn't admitted, the substance of that letter was testified to by your client. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that there are two separate grounds to support
right,
the verdict.
Right.
And again, I think 33, 35, 37 has been suggested that, well, he never contested the basis of the question. He was being cross-examined. I mean, when given the opportunity, well, what actually happened to here? What was the context of your discussions He gave the jury ample reason to conclude that he did not resign without giving notice or being able to give notice. And this is a classic jury question. Being able to observe witnesses testify and sift through these disputing facts is why we give this deference to the jury verdict. And the attempt to rechristen the evidence after the fact by the Surgical Institute on appeal should be rejected. So we believe that there is ample basis to affirm the jury verdict under the applicable standard of review. With the court's permission, I'd like to briefly discuss the unjust enrichment argument as well. As noted in our brief, there are two separate sort of challenges to this unjust enrichment claim, and I don't think it comes out what actually happens here. There's an amended complaint and an original complaint. For purposes of clarity, the original complaint was heard by Judge Teedy. Under the original complaint, the first count was implied contract or unjust enrichment. That was dismissed. Months go by. 3 business days before trial, the Surgical Institute seeks to amend the complaint. That's granted. The amendment is changed from unjust enrichment to the oral contract theory. Now, our position is that the defendant has been unfairly prejudiced by not having any notice that the unjust enrichment claim was still in the lawsuit. It's black-letter law that the amended complaint supersedes the original complaint. It wipes the slate clean. And I don't want to spend too much time on this, but as there's a case...
What about the rule that once you have a definitive ruling, then you don't have to preserve your arguments on it later? You don't have to keep making an objection. Wasn't Judge Teedy's ruling a definitive ruling?
It was. And there's some... I don't think that this is fairly esoteric. There's not case law in South Dakota on it. The case law cited from North Dakota by the Surgical Institute, if you look at the concurrence from the Chief Justice, it's exactly what happened here. The defendant is put at risk when, on the one hand, the original complaint pleads something like unjust enrichment, which is an equitable claim. And then, on the other hand, in the amended complaint, switches theories and goes to an oral contract claim, this legal claim, with no notice that the oral contract claim is still in the mix or still within the scope of the lawsuit. Now, what's happened here, if you look at page 24 of the brief by the Surgical Institute, they're saying that Dr. Sorrell made admissions as to the status of this meeting. Well, it refers to the unjust enrichment count, but they take it from a statement of undisputed facts to the amended complaint. And the defendant's placed in a double bind where he's asked to refer back to this issue that's no longer part of the lawsuit and subjected to potential attack based on strategy or whatnot that he took with the amended complaint. For that purpose, I urge that the procedural issue, if we look at Wengler versus LaRolle, which is the North Dakota case cited in their brief, the concurrence directly speaks to the problem with not asking the plaintiff to provide some degree of notice that they would be pursuing this appeal on the claim that was subsequently abandoned. If we actually address the unjust enrichment merits, it's clear that the contract between these parties contemplated that while Dr. Sorrell was an employee of the Institute, he would be eligible for employee benefits. Now, you need to deconstruct what they call fellowship benefits. On the one hand, there's accounts receivable. That is for work that Dr. Sorrell did before he left for the fellowship. He was paid that. On the other hand, there are, I think, the shorthand way to talk about it is fringe benefits, things like medical malpractice insurance, contributions to a 401k, and so on. There was no dispute based on the party's actions that Dr. Sorrell was entitled to these benefits during the course of his fellowship. I mean, they were paid. It was assumed to be the case that he remained an employee and was subject to and eligible for employee benefits.
Well, why did they have to have a stockholders meeting to agree to that, then?
There's 2 amendments. The first was the stockholder agreement, which is to address this issue of fellowship, and basically to expand it to include fellowship. If you're on fellowship, you're on leave. And that was in January 1st. The second one was on May 15th. And effectively what happened was the parties agreed that he would not be working for the Institute and wouldn't draw a salary, but that he was eligible for these benefits. And I think the question from the Chief Justice goes exactly to the point. If a specific issue is not addressed in a contract, does that automatically sprout an unjust enrichment claim when the parties, after the fact, some mutual expectation didn't come to pass.
Did he get benefits that were not mentioned in the agreements? Did he receive some benefits while he was on this leave?
He received benefits, the same benefits he would receive as an employee, as defined under Section 3 of the employment agreement. He remained an employee throughout this because he was subject to the terms of the employment agreement. This is adduced in evidence, Volume 1, page 19. He was asked, "You were an employee throughout this fellowship?" He answered, "Yes." On cross-examination, Dr. Strand was asked, "He was an employee throughout this fellowship?" The answer is yes. These weren't special fellowship benefits. These were benefits that he retained and was contractually entitled to as an employee. Now, the odd thing that I think the Institute has suggested is that despite the jury's finding that he did not fail to provide notice and during this fellowship, that the way the employment relationship ended, that as a matter of law and a matter of judgment of the jury, he did not reach the contract, there's still this nebulous unjust enrichment claim out there. Now, this was a 42-page employment agreement. My understanding is that the Institute's lawyers drafted the amendment. There was nothing in the amendment that allows this right of disgorgement or clawback based on a dispute and how this employment relationship ended. It's discussed throughout their brief as promise. I think that nomenclature is problematic. There certainly was a statement of intent that everybody involved believed that Dr. Sorrell would come back as an intent. And part of the reason that the evidence of oral statements was excluded by the trial court was because of the potential for confusion or prejudice because the Institute continued to call it promises. Now, we have defined obligations under the contract. We have these statements or promises or what have you that the Institute or the jury could understand to be superimposed on the contract. And that's a serious risk of misunderstanding or prejudice. I'd like to turn to that issue briefly if it's permissible. Obviously, this is an evidentiary ruling. It's presumed to be correct. Not only that, the abuse of discretion standard applies, but they're asking for a new trial, so it's prejudicial error. There's elements throughout their brief where they suggest that absent the ability to introduce this evidence, the jury might misunderstand or might lead to what I would deem speculative results. Well, this court has found that mere assertions of what the jury may have concluded is not sufficient to constitute prejudice.
Do we know what grounds the trial court used?
No, we do not. There's a written...
So how do we review that?
I think it's whether there was any ground, whether any of the grounds in the Rule 403 meet the standard.
Whether stated or argued by you here or there, it matters not. We can just look and try and justify a ruling.
I think the trial court rulings are presumed to be correct, and there's case law for the proposition that any ground that is legitimate should be affirmed, regardless if it's the specific trial ground that was affirmed. The suggestion at this point in time is that this oral statements of future intent, are, quote, offered to show that compliance with the notice provision was important. The subjective sense from the Institute's perspective that notice was important, that can only go to damages. That can't go to whether or not the notice provision was abided by, and it can't go to what the notice provision required of Dr. Sorrell. There's comments about meaningless technicality and juror confusion and so forth, but there's no substantive evidence to suggest that the jury could deem this notice provision to be a meaningless technicality. There's no substantive evidence to suggest that the jury could deem this, the fellowship itself, to constitute notice. In fact, the only substantive evidence in the record rebuts that inference. Dr. Sorrell was asked a hypothetical on page 37 and 38 of Volume 1 of the record during the adverse examination. And he basically said, was asked, if you resigned in June, you would have had to give notice in September. And he recognized if you applied the 9 months notice, that was true. But he said, I didn't give notice in September. I had no intent of not coming back at that time. That was sufficient to rebut this supposed inference of that the jury could be confused about when notice would have been required. There's the notice of the idea of prejudicial error. Everything about the importance of this provision, the notice provision, the Institute was able to adduce through other testimony, and they did. There was testimony that partners were shocked. They assumed that he was coming back. And that was testimony that dramatized the effect of a breach if the jury found there was a breach. And obviously the jury did not find there was a breach. Now, even if this evidence was relevant, as we talked about it, they may be excluded on other grounds. And unfair prejudice is certainly one. They talk about he has a promise to return. That leads to an unfair or illegitimate inference, or at least a risk of an unfair or illegitimate inference. Inference. He made a promise to return. He didn't return. He broke his promise, and therefore he must have breached the contract. That's a serious risk, and how do you unring that bell? The judge capably exercised her discretion in concluding that this evidence posed a risk and should be excluded, even if it was deemed relevant. The emphasis is on what actually happened, not in June 2008, not on what was expected to happen in June 2007. This was a two-day trial. The jury heard the principals testify, heard the principal accounts recounted, and the jury found for Dr. Sorrell. That result should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hagan. Mr. Moore, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Starting with the breach of contract claim, we're not trying to rewrite any story here. The transcript on this appeal, the transcript is our friend. And what I am telling you is that what Mr. Hagan said when he stood here and told you that Dr. Sorrell testified that he was willing to stay and do whatever was required to meet his contractual obligations, that testimony is not in the transcript. He talked about pages 59 to 61 of the transcript in Dr. Sorrell's testimony. I would encourage you to read it, starting on the bottom of page 58. Tell the jury about the conversation on June 10. Dr. Sorrell, I said I didn't want to come back to the practice as it was, that I had been looking at a job in Lincoln, and I wanted to take up his offer that I felt was given to me to work outside of the group and stay in town. And we talked about, the only time we ever talked about how long I would stay and cover the practice was in the context of me leaving town and going to Lincoln, which is, I had a job offer at hand then as a backup. And I offered to stay as long as the group needed me to stay to cover call and help out. To cover call and help out is not his contractual obligation. It is not full-time employment. If you disagree with my premise on that, we'll lose the case. We'll lose that argument on the breach of contract. But if you agree with my premise, we should win. Because the testimony that Mr. Hagan told you is in the transcript is not there. There is no testimony that he would do whatever was necessary to fulfill his contractual obligations. There is no testimony that he would stay and work full time and cover call, which is what his contractual obligation was. Justice Severson, I have the answer to your question that I did not have before. The deferred compensation is addressed in the shareholder agreement in Section 6. It is addressed in the employment agreement in several sections. Disability is addressed in Section 3.3.3. Military leave is addressed in Section 1.14.3. And termination of employment is addressed in Section 5.6. Whether you get to keep the deferred comp when you depart under those circumstances varies based on the situation, and it's a little bit complicated. Sometimes you get it, sometimes you don't, but there's nothing in the agreement that addresses whether you get to keep deferred comp if you go off to do a fellowship. With respect to the question about evidence of the promise to return and whether that's admissible, I would refer you to page 84 of the second volume of the transcript, where this question was asked on cross-examination. Neither the amendment to the employment contract or the amendment to the shareholders agreement required Dr. Sorrell to return afterwards, do they? And the answer to that was no, because they don't. Now, tell me how Surgical Institute can respond to that when evidence that Dr. Sorrell in fact promised to return has been excluded. There is no response, and it's obviously prejudicial. It was the key fact in the case. It is what everything hinged on. Without Dr. Sorrell's promise to return, he would not have left on a fellowship. He would not have received the benefits that he did. There would have not have been this dispute.
And so to leave that out of the trial, I don't think it makes any sense at all. And I think it's no wonder that the jury may have been confused about what the case was really about. I think it's no surprise that the jury may have reached the conclusion that they did on breach of contract, because what they knew is that the written agreements didn't require him to come back, and there was no evidence that he had promised to come back. And so in that context, how can you say that you don't know that the quest that their verdict may have been different if they had known that he had promised to return on the question of breach of contract? It's not illogical to think that they didn't understand the importance of a 9-month notice provision for a guy who's been gone for a year and who has no written obligation to come back, and there's no evidence that he's promised to come back. I think it's just, it's fundamental to the case. It's central. We don't know why the trial court excluded it, but we do know today that I think it clearly would have made a difference to the outcome of the case. And I don't have anything else unless you have additional questions.
Thank you, Mr. Moore.
Thank you.
Court will be in recess.